Welcome. It's very exciting to have you guys here, and it's exciting to talk about this. So let me start with a couple of, introductions. One is, so I'm a cosmologist by training, so my interest, you're going to see that, it does come from cosmology and astrophysics parts, but it will become obvious, hopefully, why I'm here and why I'm helping organize this meeting. Another thing as tangentially related is you do see this nice painting on my shirt. There are more of this coming, so Katja at the back, she's actually making impressions of all your talks, and there will be an exhibit at some point at the end of the week about basically pictures or impressions, artistic impressions of all your talks. So next time you give a talk, you could use those. I did use that one of those for one of the conferences that I organized based on one of her paintings. So let's get us started. So I'm going to talk about something that's kind of bizarre, but hopefully should help us understand better what may lie behind or beyond the standard model. Asymptotic safety would be one approach, and the reason I'm talking about this here is that I think that could be a promising way of basically merging what I'm talking about and what we think comes beyond a standard model. So I'm going to start with an introduction to hierarchy problem. Then I'm going to tell you what cosmological non-constant problem is, and then its implication in astrophysics, in particular cosmic microwave background and pulsar timing, and then what it implies for a physics beyond a standard model, in particular particle physics beyond a standard model. So we've all heard about the cosmological constant problem. Arguably, it goes back to Pauli. And it has to do basically if you couple a standard model or any quantum physics, quantum field theory on the right-hand side to gravity on the left-hand side of Einstein equation. Basically from quantum mechanics, at least our best understanding of quantum mechanics, which is a standard model or quantum field theory with a standard model, you could actually predict the right-hand side. And it's something that we cannot predict, we cannot be sure about the sign. But it's of order 10 to the 4th, 45 electron volt to the 4th. And in the real world, this is measured from cosmology, which is where my background, and this is 10 to the minus 12, so that's the infamous 60 orders of magnitude or so. Or I guess 57 orders of magnitude discrepancy between theory and observation, possibly the worst prediction in the history of physics. And this is the kind of thing that we have to worry about. Of course, this is kind of a ridiculous constraint in a standard model because basically this says that a standard model is already ruled out. So we have to go back and try to rethink what this really means. And you've all have heard about this. It could imply fine-tuning, possibly modification of gravity. But this is kind of the prototypical example that looking at cosmology or larger scale might teach us something about what happens on very small scales. Apparently, what teaches here is wrong, so we have to think more carefully about it. But it is possible, in principle, by studying larger scales to learn about what happens in the small scales, and that's what gravity does. Gravity is a nonlinear theory, so it can actually couple larger scales to small scales. It's just maybe not as naive as one may at first think. So what are the problems? Basically what I told you, it was a cosmological constant problem, which is a discrepancy with the scale of the universe or dark energy problem, dark energy scale, and the electroweak scale. So the so-called old cosmological constant problem is basically this 60 order magnitude discrepancy in terms of energy, or in terms of scale, it's 15 orders of magnitude discrepancy between, say, a scale of neutrino mass and a scale of electroweak symmetry breaking. And there is no natural explanation of that, even though we understand essentially all the physics that's going on here as far as quantum field theory is concerned. This scale is technically unnatural, so they should be basically coincide, but they don't. And you could extend this beyond the scale of electroweak, but that would be more speculative. So this could be 102 orders of magnitude discrepancy. There is also the Higgs hierarchy problem, which is, I mean, the motivation for supersymmetry, possibly other physics beyond the standard model that you may see at LSE. That's basically discrepancy between these two scales, the Gator-Planck scale and the Higgs scale. But these are both kind of nationalist problems, the things that you can get away with fine-tuning. They don't threaten the existential, the existence of or the consistency of a standard model or general relativity. However, it looks like they live in these fine-tuned corners that may not be the best place to live theoretically. So I'm going to tell you something new, which is a slightly different nature. It's not really a fine-tuning problem, as far as I can tell, but it actually tells you something similar that tells you that these are scales that you want to put here. They are not really natural scales to put, and it's more controversial, but there is no fine-tuning way of getting around it. And I call it the cosmological non-constant problem to become clear. So basically, I want to tell you this is a new type of hierarchy problem, but it's of a different nature. Okay. So let's get this. So this is the punchline of what's about to come. So basically, the idea is that gravity is different from any other gauge theory or quantum field theory that we have in nature, because the observables are non-local. Right? So in gravity, there is no way of writing an observable, which is local, unlike field theories or gauge theories, where you can form local observables or gauge invariant variables. In gravity, you cannot form a local gauge invariant variable. Everything is expressed as integrals over the entire space-time. So this implies that UV physics may not decouple in the same way from the IR physics as it does. So there are decoupling theorems for renormalizable theories, but gauge theories. But for gravity, there is no decoupling theorem. And in fact, I want to argue for you that the UV physics may show up as an infrared noise in the geometry in a similar flavor to the well-known cosmological constant problem, but possibly more subtle way that cannot be fine-tuned away, like the cosmological constant problem. So the conclusion of this is that basically you put an upper limit on the scale of UV physics. It's not as strict as you got from the cosmological constant problem. It's not a milli-electron volt, but it's more like a tera-electron volt. So I want to argue that basically the lack of this IR noise in geometry, in cosmology or in astrophysics, rules out essentially any massive scale above a TeV, and that leaves very little room for beyond a standard model physics. So whatever new physics you want to put in, you should put it basically within a TeV, or you cannot just introduce it as a... You cannot integrate it as, say, a high-scale SUSY, or gut particles, or any inflation model that would be ruled out, almost all inflation models. But essentially, any weakly coupled massive particle beyond the TeV would be either highly constrained or ruled out from this consideration. The things that wouldn't be ruled out if you have TeV scale quantum gravity, large extra dimension, avoid the Macron size, for example, or if you have a strongly coupled UV completion like asymptotic safety, which is one of the reasons I'm interested in this topic. But basically, the idea is that astrophysics and cosmology, by looking at gravitational effects, could tell you, put constraints on UV physics that would basically limit the number of theories or the type of theories that you should consider to complete or UV complete a standard model. So what is cosmological non-constant problem, or CNC? So the idea is that in a standard model or any quantum field theory, you have a very vibrant vacuum. And in particular, this implies that your energy momentum tensor is not a constant. It actually does fluctuate. If you look at the expectation value of the two-point function of an energy momentum tensor is not the product of the expectation value of the energy momentum tensors. That means that it's a fluctuating field, and that's what you expect from quantum mechanics or quantum field theory. Any quantum field does have fluctuations, and energy momentum tensors that you build out of them would fluctuate as well. So, So then what is the analog of Kazimierz constant if you think about these two-point functions? And would it have a gravitational effect? That's the question that we ask. And then basically the question is, can these fluctuations, independent of the mean is the vacuum energy, but the fluctuation is something completely independent, and you could ask whether those fluctuations could have an observable gravitational effect. So this is the first paper where we discuss this, and there is a subsequent paper that I'm gonna mention later in the talk. So this is the question. Do the fluctuations of an energy momentum tensor gravitate? And this is an independent problem from the cosmological constant, because even if you subtract the mean, there would be always fluctuations around the mean, independent of whatever you subtracted. And those fluctuations, at least if you imagine a standard quantum field theory plus a standard gravity or Einstein gravity, they should gravitate as well. So in the first paper, the calculations that we did was basically was the standard cosmological calculation. We looked at the scalar modes and the vector modes. It turns out tensor mode didn't make a big difference. And you solve them, and on the right-hand side of this, we put the energy momentum tensor of a quantum field, a massive quantum field. And there's a simple way to see what comes out of those calculations. The thing is, if you think about a massive field, basically, stress correlations at some constant time surface on large distances that would be essentially uncorrelated, because these are random massive fields that would fluctuate independently at different points in the space. So if you look at the correlation function, essentially it would be zero except at coincidence. You're interested in larger scale observables. So just on dimensional grounds, you would have some delta function times some UV scale. So for example, the mass of your particle to the fifth power. So this is dimensionally, this is what you get. Now, if you just plug this into Einstein equations, just this correlation function into Einstein equations, which is basically something like this, the Laplacian of metric fluctuations is 1 over m Planck squared times some projection of this stress tensor. Then again, on dimensional grounds, you know, it should go, the variance of metric should go as lambda to the fifth. But then you are squaring this, so it would be 1 over m Planck to the fourth. So dimensionally, this should go as lambda to the fifth divided by m Planck to the fourth times some length, times some vector wave number, or k. So some momentum scale, or times some length if you want. So this would be just the relative fluctuations in metric. And here's an interesting thing, that this thing actually blows up in the infrared if you just believe in this simple dimensional argument. Even though I was putting in some UV physics here, the gravitational effect of it actually blows up in the infrared. And that's a very non-trivial thing. So in fact, you could say that there is an infrared scale or infrared cutoff on the theory where this becomes of order one, which is goes as a UV scale to the fifth divided by m Planck to the fourth. So this is a dimensional argument. So this is what we call the cosmological non-constant, you could call it the cosmological non-constant problem if you're interested in UV scales that are, for which this IR scale is bigger than the Hubble constant, because of course we can observe things on cosmological scales, and we know everything is weakly coupled, and that's where the constraints come from. Okay, any questions? So this can be done, so if you just plug in the Hubble constant as the IR scale, that because we can basically observe a metric all the way up to the Hubble scale, and the metric seems to have basically small fluctuations, you would put an upper limit on this lambda UV, which is of order PeV, which is the 1,000 or 2,000 TeV.
So what's the physical meaning of lambda UV when you're doing this?
So you could think of it as the mass of the most massive particle in the theory, or any UV scale, yeah. But basically, this is the idea, is that if you look at the two-point function of a stress tensors, basically at large distances is zero, because it's a massive field, but then there is some, if you integrate over it, around over the zero separation, there will be some coefficient there. So that's what it is. I'm gonna make it a little bit more clear in a second. Okay. So you could make this more rigorous by looking at the Lorentz invariant structure of this two-point correlation function. And this is the so-called Shalane-Lehmann representation, which you could do for any operators, but in particular, I'm doing it for a stress tensor. And given the symmetries of a stress tensor and the conservation law, or Ward identities, basically that should be divergence-less, there are basically two scalars that you could construct as a function of mu, where mu is essentially energy scale. And basically, if you specify these two functions, that specifies the entire Lorentz invariant structure of this two-point function. So there is a spin zero part and a spin two part, depending on basically this part that describes the trace correlation, a correlate of the trace, and this part describes the traceless part of the correlation. So that's why it's called spin zero and spin two. And so this generally you could find this in textbooks. One constraint is that these rows must be positive, but for any quantum field theory which is Lorentz invariant, if you're in a Lorentz invariant vacuum, these are enough to describe the entire content for as far as this correlation function is concerned. So basically what I want to argue in the next few minutes is that cosmological observations constrain some integral over these rho 2, and it could be also integral over rho 0, the direct constraints come from rho 2. And basically it says that this integral should be less than something of order TeV to PeV to the fifth power from cosmology. And much more strict constraints come from pulsar timing, which is of order 600 GeV to the fifth power. So you could see that this has the right dimension. These rows have dimension of energy to the fourth. So this has dimension of energy to the fifth, which is basically what the metric fluctuations are proportional to. So if I go back in this calculation, this coefficient is proportional to integral of rho d mu over the square root of mu. Okay, so
cosmological non-constant problem means that if you try to compute rho 2, theoretically you get
good. So that depends on the. So if you have scales that are bigger than this in your theory, right, then you have a problem. So for the standard model, you're barely okay, right?
Still a fine-tuning problem or
not? Well, so this is the thing that because these are variances, they don't cancel. So it would be they all have the same signs for bosons and fermions. So it's not that you could just add things to cancel variances. Now, whether there are other ways of canceling them, that's yet to be seen, but it's not as obvious. Like for vacuum energy, you could just have, if you have the right number and mass of bosons and fermions, they could cancel. For because these are variances, it's not clear whether there is any way to cancel them. Okay, good. So let's see what these rows are. So these rows, for free field theories, you could actually calculate them. They have very nice structures, and actually they're analytic. We have these expressions, actually. Elliot has calculated all of this for all scalars, vectors, for Dirac and Majorana fermions. And basically, they all have this structure. They have all this square root, which has a branch point at 4 ms squared. So this mu has a dimension of energy squared. So if the mass m is the mass of the particle, they all have branch points and branch cuts at the start at 4 ms squared. But they also have a branch cut sitting at the center at mu equal to 0, or around mu equal to 0. So here is the crux of the calculation, is that all the calculations that you do, you have to integrate over rho starting from 4 ms squared onwards. But you could do an analytic continuation, all these integrals, it turns out that for observables, they're symmetric, so you're doing an integral going around one branch cut and another branch cut. But you can actually close the contour by adding something at infinity and close it to basically this integral around the branch cuts centered at zero. And it turns out that all the field theories that we look at have a universal structure that look like this. This is for a scalar, but it turns out for any field theory, for fermions, bosons, vector bosons, you name it, they all have this universal structure. Goes as basically some number that goes as mass to the fifth times the dimensionless constant divided by a square root of mu. So If you buy this analytic continuation trick that they can ignore this contract infinity, and that's something that may or may not be right, then all the calculations actually have a universal form that basically only depends on this coefficient that in front of 1 over square root of mu. So we can now go and do some concrete calculations. So we've done two of them. One is the so-called ISW effect in cosmology, or integrated Sachs-Wolfe effect. And the idea is that if you look at cosmic microwave background photons, they propagate through the universe from last scattering, redshift of 1,000 to us. And if the metric along the way changes, so this is the cartoon of that, then the photons that go into the potential wells experience a different blue shift from the redshift that they experience when they come out. So in this case, then it might be effectively blue shifted or redshifted. So this is something that you observe in cosmology for standard cosmological fluctuations. But if you're adding these new metric fluctuations, or new matter fluctuations that source new metric fluctuations, you get extra contribution to this ISW effect. And the power spectrum of that basically goes m to the fifth times time. This would be the cosmological time, which is 14 gigayears, divided by m Planck to the fourth. So you can go and look at the cosmological data. This is a Sachs-Wolfe telescope, which is the highest resolution CMB map that you have in the universe. And then if you plug that in, this gives you a mass which is less than 24 TeV. Now, so this puts an upper limit on the biggest, most massive particle. This is for a scalar. For other particles, it would be tighter because there are more degrees of freedom. But basically, it's the biggest scalar you could say, you could have that's consistent with basic CMB observations is 24 TeV. Anything more massive than that would be ruled out. Unless there is some other contribution which we've ignored and somehow exactly cancels this. But the point is that there is actually no free parameter here. So these calculations are exact. You see, it's not a cosmological constant, but you estimate and there are logs that you assume of order one. There is no free parameter anywhere here. So this was good. We thought this was pretty remarkable. And the next thing that happened was, Tony, where is Tony? Is he left. Okay. So I was teaching astrophysics, and one thing that I do, I tell students to come up with a project to work on. And then Tony, who's a student, master's student, was teaching, Tony Kim, he asked me whether you could test quantum gravity with pulsar timing. Then I started thinking about it is that, in fact, pulsar timing is a much more precise way of measuring geometry than CMB, because here, these fluctuations, the metric is 10 to the minus 5, so you measure geometry to 1 part in 10 to the 5. But in pulsar timing, you can actually measure geometry to 1 part in 10 to the 15, 10 orders of magnitude more precise. So that, in fact, makes a big difference. So the idea there is that if you have these pulsars, they're very precise clocks, and you can measure basically how regularly you see the pulses from them, and it turns out some of them are so regular that basically they preclude any metric perturbations that are bigger than 1 part in 10 to the 15. So this is usually translated to some amplitude of metric fluctuations, although what you really measure is the timing noise of the pulses, and you see them with these radio telescopes. And it turns out if you do the same calculation, and it turns out this is a much more clean calculation because everything you're doing, everything in Minkowski space. So everything is Lorentz invariant and gauge invariant. You can do this, and then you get a result. And then we've done it for all possible particles you could have in quantum field theory. And this is how it looks like. There is something that's weird that is negative. And this is something that you do get in quantum field theories that the power spectra and can be negative. But we still don't know exactly how to interpret this negative sign. There is the idea that if you add terms that depend on the cutoff, then the full thing should be positive. Like Casimir energy is negative. How much time do I have?
You are 25 minutes on the
clock. Okay. Good. So So Casimir energy could be negative. So the thing with the power spectrum, this is, it's not entirely clear whether, I mean, there is a way to make this more sensible, but there must be terms that depend on a cutoff that makes this positive, but, okay, so this is really where the theoretical, something to be understood here, that it's either there are additional contributions that could exactly cancel this, or there's additional contribution that just makes it positive, but they're more cutoff dependent. And that's kind of the nature of negative things you get in quantum field theory, that there are. The full thing should be positive if it's a fair variance, but then there are cutoff dependent parts and cutoff independent parts. But anyway, so that's there is a problem to be understood there. But if you just take this literally as, say, absolute value, it's again, it's a Lorentz invariant calculation. And if you plug it in, say, for this particular pulsar, so in fact, this is observed over, say, 10 years. This is in Australia, this arc pulsar timing array. And you can see that you could see pulses regularly with the precision of less than a microsecond over 10 years. And that basically translates to a upper limit on metric fluctuations of 10 to the minus 15. If you plug it into the formula I gave you, you get the biggest mass of 600 GeV, basically. This would be for a scalar, for other, spinners, or for vectors, it would be even higher, a tighter constraint. So this suggests that maybe there isn't really much physics beyond a star model, which I know is not the best thing to say. But there is very little room left between basically the mass of the top and the Higgs, which are 125 and 173. GeV, and a 600 GeV limit. And in fact, if you look at a particle-like top, which is basically a Dirac fermion, the highest mass that it could have is 400 GeV in our calculation. So, and in fact, I gave a version of this talk 2 years ago at Niels Bohr Institute in Copenhagen, where the hot thing in particle physics was this diphoton excess, three sigma diphoton excess that there are, I guess, hundreds of papers were written on this. So it said that basically this cannot be possible. I mean, it wouldn't be consistent. Of course, it did go out. In August, this went away. So I don't say this is exact prediction per se, but anyway, so far everything is consistent with what I've presented to you. If tomorrow there's a particle that's discovered at the TEV, then there is either something we don't understand about this calculation, but as I told you, it's a very clean calculation, or that TEV thing is going to go away, like the 750 GeV thing. So anyway, so that's the status. So let me wrap up. So there's something about effective field theory I can tell you about. I think basically, if it comes to gravity, you cannot really trust effective field theory all the way in the infrared. So I'm just gonna, if you want, let me just skip to the conclusion. So I have some stuff about effective field theory. So there are open questions. So what about early universe, inflation, dark matter? So there are theories that would be consistent with the constraints, but much fewer than you're used to. There is this damn, it's supposed to be minus sign, I said minute sign, yeah. I think this is the autocorrect. Yeah, this especially works too well for her. So this is the damn minus sign. We still don't understand it. So if you're really unlucky, there's something else that exactly canceled it. Maybe that's what it means. But yeah, so there seems that we have a very clean calculation. It's just that, yeah, so we have to understand what that minus sign means. What happens beyond linear order? What is this nature of IR cutoff? Could it be actually responsible for dark energy somehow? And I mean, there seems to be some connections to holography, which I can tell you about if you're interested in. So basically, this is the upshot. Quantum gravity could couple UV and IR. So in astrophysics, if we, at least the simplest interpretation of our results, that there's no particles, no particle scale beyond, say, 24 TeV from CMB. So this could be consistent with something like large extra dimension, conformal Higgs, or some non-perturbative solution to quantum gravity like asymmetric safety. EFT, I don't believe it when it comes to gravity. And finally, I mean, you have this even much tighter constraint, moduli this negative sign that we don't understand. from pulsar timing, and it even could be a target for light, LISA and LIGO. Okay, thank you.
Yeah, thank you very much for this inspiring talk. I'm sure we have many questions. I see the first hand over there.
One question. As far as understanding, you use like two-point function with energy momentum tensor. Are you sure that higher order correlation are not intervening in this or are suppressed?
Right. So, I mean, if you have a free theory, the two-point function is what we are observing. The question is, would the higher order loops basically have much bigger corrections to this? That's a good question. I haven't thought about that. So you think higher order loops just from gravity? So I think that those are Planck suppressed. So that's what I think we looked at. Now, if you have other couplings, say, for example, Higgs self-coupling and things like that would have order one corrections to this. But if you're just dealing with free theories, I think higher order loops are Planck suppressed.
So, yeah, I'm just want some clarification on one of the details of tight bounds. So you're looking at the TT correlation, right?
Yes.
Now, are you, at one slide you had the CX that took different values.
Yes, that's right, yeah.
Depending on how many, on what
one particle
you
that's
have.
Right, yeah.
So what if I, is this just for one particle? What these scales are for the calculations say. So what if I have n particles?
You just add this up, yeah.
So does that get multiplied by n?
So if you have n particles of the same mass, you just add this for all the particles. Like you don't, that's right. You multiply by n, that's
right. So I multiply the whole thing by n.
Yeah, right.
So the limit basically goes, there's a
so this is just
to the 1/5 or something?
That's right.
And so the larger, although it's even to the 1/5, the larger n is, the tighter that bound.
Yeah, gets. And in fact, this number, even though, it was a very, very hard calculation to get all of these, it's really just counting the number of degrees of freedom.
Yeah.
Number of this, phi is 1, complex is 2.
But that
my run, yeah.
Mass limit is really if I just have one particle.
So yeah.
I imagine I have a whole bunch of
that's
particles,
right.
The limit gets even.
That's right, but of course, usually, this is dominated by the most massive particle that you have, right? Because this goes as
empty. If they're all the same, right? I mean,
if they're all the same?
Large NF and they're all the same.
Absolutely, yeah.
It pushes this.
It definitely pushes it down. Yes, it definitely pushes it down. If you have
that's
NF, yep. Yep, that's right. Yes?
I'm still having a lot. So you're saying we should first assume the minus sign gets corrected and interpret it as a positive contribution? Of the same order?
So the minus sign is something very weird. Basically the idea, I tell you what is our latest idea. So the idea is that there are things like the log corrections to this, and that there are other things that would depend on a cutoff, but generically they wouldn't exactly cancel this and they have different frequency and length dependent. So the idea would be that, so the sum of everything should be positive, but this term on its own cannot be too big because then it would dominate, and of course it wouldn't be correct.
But then how? The final result might be orders of magnitude smaller.
Well, no, but it would be very because it wouldn't be self-consistent basically because then if these other terms have different L and omega dependencies, so they cannot exactly cancel each other over large ranges in. Length and omega. So now this is a fair point, but this is a type of fine-tuning argument that you say if you want this negative to cancel everything else, you have to fine-tune it. But you have to fine-tune it over various lengths and various omegas, and then that cannot happen basically, right? Because they have different L and omega dependencies. And if you fine-tune it over at some L and omega, but they have different L and omega dependencies, then it becomes negative elsewhere very quickly. And then, of course, that's not a physical answer. Okay. Yes.
So when you're doing the contour integral.
Yes.
What were the branch cuts, the big branch cuts?
Yeah. So these are branch cuts that go to infinity.
Okay.
And then there is this branch cut that sits at the center. And the idea is that we kind of deform the integrals around these branch cuts into integral around this branch cut.
Sorry, what do the branch cuts correspond to? I've got one.
So, that's right. So there is one for mu bigger than 4 ms squared.
Yeah.
And there is another one for negative mu. Okay. Are there questions?
Maybe I have a question. Is your setup, so to what extent is your setup sensitive to the UV nature of gravity? I mean, there is a UV cutoff of some type which we've seen, but is there some way you can make maybe UV sensitivity?
Right. So the thing is, I mean, I first expressed it in terms of UV cutoff, but really this is the cutoff independent result. This goes at just the mass of the particles. So there could be cutoff dependent parts, but basically the concrete results are the parts that are cutoff independent, which are basically things like this, or this result. These are cutoff independent. So there could be cutoff dependent parts, but they would be Lorentz violating and wouldn't contribute. Well, they wouldn't show up here. But indeed, there would be cutoff dependent parts that you have to add to this. So what we are assuming is basically these masses are much less than M Planck. So you're using GR, right? But that's basically the only assumption here. So the point is that these are things that exist in the theory. They're Lorentz invariant. There should be some sort of deep reason if they're not there. And so far, I mean, as far as we know, they could be there.
When I see that correctly, I mean, your analysis looks at certain, say, infrared effects.
That's right, yeah.
Okay. Now, there has been this speculation in the gravity field, say, that perhaps even in the deep infrared, quantum gravity could have some effect. It's perhaps a bit more speculative than maybe the UV. Okay, but people have been thinking about it. So this is an idea as if gravity could perhaps in the deep infrared develop an interacting fixed point, which then would mean that G Newton or the gravitational force effectively becomes a bit stronger.
Yep.
Now is that something?
It is. This is very similar to that.
Type of consideration or analysis would be sensitive to, because that would be interesting, because that could potentially constrain maybe the size of such an infrared fixed point, or maybe the scale at which the crossover to such a fixed point.
But I mean, this is you could just consider this as a rigorous evidence. To the extent that the loopholes that I mentioned, that this could be evidence for that infrared fixed point, because indeed the metric fluctuations do become nonlinear at some infrared scale, basically where this crosses one. So that could be evidence for that, and it's kind of very intriguing that happens to be the same. I mean, same ballpark as the dark energy scale. Of course, it's not exactly the same as dark energy scale, but we don't really know what happens beyond the horizon. So somewhere between tens of TeV and TeV scale is where basically where the limit is. And if you put this mass scale there, then gravity on horizon scale, or a few orders of magnitude within a horizon scale, becomes nonlinear. That means that it's strongly coupled, basically. That's the only way to interpret it. So I think I would say this points in that direction. And the thing is, this is not, I mean, to the extent that this calculation is rigorous, it's not really a hand-waving argument. This is a concrete calculation. And there's no cutoff dependence.
So, can I go?
Yeah, absolutely.
To the contour.
Yes.
So how do you know that the contour around the at infinity is going to zero?
No, we don't. So that's kind of what depends on the UV structure. So I mean, just saying that, we just ignore that.
Right.
And it says we assume that it's zero. I think there is one way so the question is, why should these two exactly cancel each other, basically? But because this is kind of the speculative part, that we assume that there's something that happens in UV, but that happens at very high energies, much beyond the mass scales that we're dealing with, or much beyond the infrared scale that we're interested in. And the chances of that exactly canceling what happens basically around this contour, we say the chances is zero, or chances are unlikely, but there is no, I mean, I don't think there is any good way to say what happens without actually know the full UV completion. And in fact, I would imagine that if you do have a UV, because it is actually divergence integrals. Right?
Yeah, that's. I mean, so in a field theory, what would happen is if I took an arc and then a slightly bigger arc, the difference would be the difference in the divergences.
Right. So these are parallel divergences that sit up here. So usually, I mean, field theory you say, because they're parallel divergences, you say they're absorbed by denormalization. So that's kind of the argument that we have, but it's not an entirely rigorous argument. The thing that does convince me that these decouple from each other, this is a fully Lorentz invariant result, just what sits down here. So I don't know of any symmetry that would require these two to cancel each other. So in a sense, this is, if you believe that Minkowski space needs to be the right vacuum state for the theory, your theory of quantum gravity, then these two must cancel each other. So that's kind of reversing the argument. But if you don't believe Minkowski space is the correct vacuum state, then they could be, basically, they don't have to cancel each other. And then, I mean, as far as any particle that we know, they don't have to cancel each other.
Let's say you find a really heavy particle,
And
I then want to go in and try to fix this.
Yeah.
I'm not getting these fluctuations. Do you have any candidate theories that would accomplish that?
Well, I mean, I think the simplest way is then to say that this, you put something up there that cancels this, basically. Yeah. So this is the thing that usually when you have, different terms that cancel each other that come from very different scales, there must be some symmetry. Like this is usually, this is why we're looking for a symmetry, like supersymmetry or something that fixes, say, the Higgs hierarchy problem, right? The only symmetry that forces this to be the same is, I argue that basically is Poincaré symmetry, assuming that you live in a Minkowski space. So if you assume you live in a Minkowski space, so there's Poincaré symmetry, then these two should cancel each other. But there is no evidence for that because we know on larger scales we don't live in a Minkowski space. So I don't think that there is reason to believe these two should exactly cancel. There could be another reason, but I cannot think of one. Well, I guess I haven't come up with one.
Unlike the cosmological constant problem, in this case, a supersymmetric spectrum doesn't help you.
Yeah, exactly, because the all contribute the same sign. So this everything contributes the same. And this actually goes to the same thing about, so unitarity imposes that all these densities are positive, so they cannot cancel each other.
Okay.
So I guess we can switch to discussion.
Yes,
okay. Thank you.